Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. I personally take Super Beets when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beets gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at IntelligentBeets.com. That's IntelligentBeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, which is a session in which we answer your questions, and I do so in the good company of Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. And welcome to your segment once again, Layla. How are you doing?
All right, Dr. Hoffman. How are you today?
And by the way, you are gracing our airwaves twice this week because remember we recorded the week before a clinical focus on gluten, and it's finally posted it this week. So so people are going to get their fill of our interaction, and that's one I highly recommend because if you haven't heard it and you want the 411 on gluten, it's quite an elaborate discussion featuring. Particularly of interest is your comments on hidden sources of gluten, because we tend to look at the obvious when we try to get gluten out of our lives, and there are actually lots of hidden sources of gluten that may assail us from directions that we least expect. So that's
it's
what
not just the bread and the pasta. That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. So check that out. Clinical Focus Gluten. Among our podcasts this week. Also, I don't know if you've had a chance to hear it because it just was posted. It was a podcast that I did with Dr. Nathan Bryant, who is the chief medical officer for Neogenis. That's a company that makes a new nitric oxide stimulating supplement. The supplement's called Super Beets. Remember I told you a little bit about
Super
that?
Super Beets. Okay.
Yeah. It's quite a fascinating story. And this product is really legit. I've been test driving it as a sort of a pre-exercise energizer. But there's more to it than just supercharging your exercise performance. There's a whole story behind nitric oxide, as you know, Layla. And this product is legit. It really is scientifically documented. And it's well worth your listen if you check out our podcast with Dr. Bryant.
I will. Terrific.
So I know that's going to become a favorite. And all right, what do we have in store for us today?
Okay, we have an email from Arlene. She says, last year I had blood sugar at 95. I'm assuming she means fasting blood sugar. Mm-hmm. I went off sugar, now it's 90. I read that 90 is not good either, so what should I do? Should I give up grains? Is gluten a problem for blood sugar? What do I do? Well, Arlene, congratulations for giving up sugar and your fasting blood sugar going from a 95 to a 90 is still good. Although we like to see it in the middle range of normal, probably closer to 80, but the fasting blood sugar, as we know, Dr. Hoffman, really doesn't tell us the whole story.
Exactly. I mean, we like to see optimizers like, what is her name, Arlene?
Mm-hmm.
To completely hang your hat on a fasting blood sugar as the hallmark of whether you're well or not is not really, I think, the right way to go, because there's a lot of wobble in fasting blood sugars. They're not completely accurate. And 5 points here or there could be just a coincidence, or it could be just the luck of the draw in terms of the state of your metabolism on a given day. It is not necessarily a reflection of your previous diet. So, I mean, it could be a perfectly healthy individual could have a fasting blood sugar of 90 or 95. Maybe that's a little high, but I'm not sure that's entirely reliable. Of course, you know, your next comment is going to be, you know, what is the reliable test? And I think you can give us an idea.
It's the glucose tolerance test, the 5-hour glucose tolerance test. That really tells us, because oftentimes we see a person come in and we see they have a fasting blood sugar to be even like 88 or 92 or something like that. And we give them a glucose tolerance test, and the question is, well, why do I need that? I don't have diabetes. And my answer is, we don't know. We don't know what you have. We don't know what your blood sugar does with a carbohydrate challenge. That's what we need to see, how your body actually reacts, how far up your blood sugar goes, how much insulin are you secreting. It could very well be that a person with a fasting blood sugar in their 90s may be pre-diabetic, may have hyperinsulinism, which is a feature of the metabolic syndrome, or maybe a full-blown diabetic if their two-hour blood sugar goes near or above 200. So it's the fasting blood sugar often gives everyone a false sense of security, but, you know, that's really all mainstream doctors are looking at. Oh, your fasting blood sugar is normal. Even when the normal range is between 65 and 99, and you're at a 97 or a 95, oh, you're still normal, go home, you're fine.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Not necessarily, and this is where we're able to pull back the curtain on what's really going on.
Oh, that's a very good answer. And, of course, you know, for those who can't get a glucose tolerance test, that's the ultimate test, and I think a very important test. I remember when I first got into medicine, I remember seeing patients who had come to me after seeing Dr. Atkins, and they always had with them copies of glucose tolerance tests. So I learned early on that this is an important test to perform. And I've been doing the test for pretty nearly 30 years in our practice. Very valuable test. And I actually got the question the other day, in terms of we know about conventional blood tests. If there was one test that you could order on patients that's not usually ordered to predict their health or lack thereof, which test would you order? And my answer was a glucose tolerance test with insulin. Yeah. And qualified
with
it by
insulin.
Saying with insulin, yeah. Because insulin, you could even have normal blood sugars, but your insulin could be elevated, suggesting that you're on a way to metabolic syndrome. And that accounts for about 60% of the way that people end up getting sick and dying in America.
That's very interesting. And again, the GTT will come back on the blood sugar end completely normal. Those numbers will be within the normal range, but they are hypersecreting insulin.
Yeah.
This is very, very important. And, you know, a standard glucose tolerance test, an oral glucose challenge that's given to pregnant women lasts about 3 hours, but they're only showing the blood sugar. It's also the insulin that's important, too, but not just for pregnant women, but all the rest of us. So,
indeed.
Very, very important.
Now, short of that, you know, if the person had written us, Arlene, I believe your name is, that they had the results of a hemoglobin A1C, that test is a little closer to providing us with more reliable information. Although that test, by the way, has problems. I've noticed that there actually are disparities between that result and the potential for someone to show abnormalities on a glucose tolerance test. Mm-hmm. There are genetic predispositions to higher hemoglobin A1C or lower hemoglobin A1C. We consider normal, well, you know, under 6 is considered not diabetic, but past 5.7 or 5.8, you get into sort of an intermediate zone of pre-diabetes. Before they call it full-blown diabetes, some doctors wait until it's 6.2 or above. I think that's is too permissive.
It is. It absolutely is. Because, you know, in the pre-diabetic range, everything is reversible, but even in the diabetic range, it's reversible, except for very late-stage diabetes.
Yeah.
When the pancreas is worn out and is no longer secreting insulin, now you're stuck. Now you've got to inject or take insulin.
Indeed.
And that's the rest of your life, yeah.
Okay. So Arlene, thanks for being conscientious, but
yeah.
We wish you'd be conscientious using a better metric of your health.
Mm-hmm. Find a doctor to give you a glucose tolerance test with insulin, a 5-hour. In the meantime, if you're overweight, get down to a healthy weight, limit your intake of grains. All of these things will help if you do have an impaired glucose tolerance or an abnormal GTT or anything like that. All of that can be reversible.
Perfect. All
Best
right.
Best of luck, Arlene. Yeah.
What else we got?
Okay. We've got an email from Sheila. Please ask Dr. Hoffman to comment on the recent New York Times article citing Alzheimer's research in which plaques and tangles were grown in a petri dish from neurons said to be from Alzheimer's genes. This research appears to rule out other causes of the disease. Now, Sheila didn't give to us a link to this article.
Right.
But I think her message is that it's genetic, isn't it? And that's it.
Right,
Alzheimer's?
That it's fate, right?
Yeah.
And that, well, you know, what she's saying is, like, surely, I mean, I think the implication is, surely in a petri dish, you know, if the cells grow that way, then Alzheimer's disease can't be the result of smoking or the result of poor diet or lack of certain vitamins, because it grows, you know, anyway. I mean, Maybe there's a certain fatalism about that, because we actually see that we have a model outside the body in which Alzheimer's develops. But I don't think for any reason that should put to the lie the theory that taking anti-inflammatory nutrients. I mean, recently there was an article that suggests that just a gram of turmeric, not even high quality turmeric extract like curcumin, bioavailable curcumin, but just good old fashioned turmeric that you get, you know, in the kitchen cabinet, can somewhat forestall memory loss.
And you know, Dr. Hoffman, in that petri dish is nothing but those plaques and tangles and those neurons. There isn't anything in that petri dish to stop it.
Right.
This is the problem with in vitro rather than in vivo.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on in the body?
I would also give this analogy, and they've done this. There's a book called it's the story of Helen Lane, who is the person who is the progenitor of virtually all the cancer cells that they grow in test tubes throughout the world to test cancer drugs and to study the growth of cancer cells. And the line of cells, and you can buy these from biological stock houses. It's the HeLa line of cancer cells. And they grow like crazy in a test tube. And her name was Helen Lane, so they called it the HeLa, H-E-L-A line. It's an interesting book about what the person was really like, who, in fact, has contributed so much to our knowledge of cancer, although we haven't beat it. We, you know more about it because of her contribution after death. Does that mean that the cancer that she developed was not related to the possibility that she had a poor diet or that she was a smoker? I mean, I don't know what was the proximate cause, but you could create a cancer with smoking cigarettes or with lack of antioxidants or whatever, environmental pollution, chemicals, and then the cancer will grow fine outside the influence of those things in a test tube. Once it's developed, it's off to the races. You know, so I think I'm answering. We don't really quite know where this person's going with that comment, but I think that's what she's suggesting, is it's just cancers, once you flip the switch, you know, it's just inevitable and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, and it's not so. I would like to think that it's not so, especially based on just this one instance of growing it in a petri dish.
I said cancer, I meant Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, Alzheimer's, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, what's of interest is that drug companies are actually pulling back on research on blockbuster Alzheimer's drugs. Because
they're not working,
and they're working on this plaque theory, and they're trying to interrupt the formation of plaques with drugs that target the plaque. And so far, they've just struck out miserably, and they've spent we're not even talking tens or hundreds of millions. They have literally spent billions of dollars in the quest for effective anti-Alzheimer's meds. And so far, what we have are meds that somewhat slow the symptoms down, but don't get at the bottom of the problem, and then they ultimately don't work. And so even mainstream medical journals and mainstream media are pointing out that the few things we know about Alzheimer's is that you can slow it down with various lifestyle interventions, with exercise, with memory games, and with anti-inflammatory diet, keeping we talked earlier about hemoglobin A1C. For each 1/10 of a point, your hemoglobin A1C goes up, your chances for dementia go up dramatically. So,
diabetes of the brain. And Dr. Hoffman, haven't some better known or integrative neurologists already claim that those beta amyloid plaques are part of the metabolism of the brain? And the pharmaceutical industry is targeting the wrong place. Those plaques are supposed to develop, but they're also supposed to be excreted, somehow broken down.
So in other words, it's
in a normal brain.
What it's saying is that they are an effect, not a cause. That they're just the effect, the body's effort to defend itself from the Alzheimer's degenerative process. And so, you know, it's kind of a little bit like if your house is on fire and you use a fan to blow away all the smoke, Does that mean that your house is not going to burn down?
Right.
I think that's sort of an analogy there. Okay, we got rid of the smoke. Hey, there's no smoke. Oh, but the fire is still blazing.
Not good.
Right.
Exactly. Anyway, Sheila, there's a lot more to it than that New York Times article, I'm sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Our next question is from Lorraine. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, do you think that the prebiotics that are in some probiotics can hinder overcoming a candida problem? You travel wherever I go. Heartfelt thanks for always being there, Dr. Hoffman.
So this person listens to the podcast in their
car
or maybe commuting or something. You know, actually, it's kind of cool because we do know quite a few people who, you know, they have long commutes and it's boring. And, you know, I guess you can, you know, read the paper or, you know, look at Facebook or something. You can also enrich yourself if you're stuck for an hour or so in a car or a train and listen to a podcast. And a lot of people have incorporated that into their routine. So we're very grateful that our audience is growing that way. So, okay, good question. So,
yeah, the prebiotics and there are prebiotics in foods too. Not all prebiotics, I don't think, would support a candida overgrowth or hinder somebody trying to overcome.
Well, let's look at it from a little different standpoint.
Yeah.
We talk about candida overgrowth. You know, what candida means is a fungal overgrowth. But actually, candida has become a word that is easily interchanged with dysbiosis, which means a little more general word, which means an overgrowth not necessarily of just fungus. It could be fungus, but it could also be an overgrowth of bad bacteria. And in a model where we attempt to get rid of bad bacteria, in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, we prescribe a diet called the specific carbohydrate diet, the SCD. And in that diet, certain of these prebiotics, like Jerusalem artichoke, inulin, these are illegal. They're actually not allowed because they're thought to feed in a potentially harmful way the proliferation of bacteria. Am I right? Inulin is not a favored...
Inulin is not a favorite for somebody with Crohn's ulcerative colitis.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad for everyone.
Exactly.
And it is a prebiotic. It actually promotes the growth of hopefully healthy bacteria.
Yeah.
But not always. I mean,
but
it can backfire.
That can backfire. I mean, if prebiotics are feeding healthy bacteria, it could also feed bad bacteria to some extent. That sounds reasonable.
Yeah. How do you know?
That's a great question, Lorraine.
Yeah, no, I think it's a thoughtful question.
It would depend. I guess it would depend on the prebiotic. I mean, you know, pistachios contain prebiotics. I don't think they're going to, you know, exacerbate a candida overgrowth. The kiwi extract in Flowey, which helps maintain bowel regularity, I don't think that's going to feed candida.
By the way, let's give that product some attention. It's spelled P-H-L-O-E. P-H-L-O-E. Flowey, I think that's pronunciation.
Yeah, some people pronounce it flow, and I'm not sure.
And so this is let me talk briefly about this product. This is a product that is derived from the New Zealand kiwi, and it's a product that actually helps regularize bowel movements. In other words, it's a very mild but effective laxative that doesn't cause urgency that you can't become dependent on because it's a prebiotic. It changes your flora.
Mm-hmm. And not a stimulant, yeah.
So we got a lot of patients to try it, and they swear by it. So much so that when the company that makes it, which is a New Zealand-based company, decided to stop importing it to the United States, there was an uproar. Mm-hmm. Our patients
were... Oh, there was.
It was like, oh, my goodness, doomsday. You got to do something about this. So what we did was we actually made arrangements with them, and we don't usually do this, to import the product directly from New Zealand. And they made it so it could come through customs. You know, we usually don't want to hassle with that, but we made sure that the product is still available to our patients. And patients, I mean, it's like those patients who, you know, sometimes a medication is discontinued. They'll travel to Tijuana or something to buy the medication. You know, they'll go across the border to Mexico to get it if they can, you know. But so anyway, that is a pretty good prebiotic. Another example is, you know, FOS, fructose oligosaccharides, which is, I think it's derived from Jerusalem artichoke. That's something that can be helpful for constipation. It helps to restore flora. But some patients say they're really bothered by it. They get a lot of gas, bloating, and they don't like it.
You know, it does. FOS is known to feed candida, and it's also a FODMAP.
Okay.
So
maybe you can brief explanation of that.
Yeah, the FODMAPs are fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, phenols. These that can cause distress, GI distress, in certain people who are intolerant to them. These are mostly fermentable carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, too many carbohydrates will also feed candida or dysbiosis.
Yep.
So it's best to, you know, curb it's
the,
all that.
It's the O in FODMAPs. FODMAP
yes,
stands for
fructose,
oligosaccharides, disaccharides, mm-hmm. monosaccharides, and
phenols.
And polyols. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a diet that we use pretty effectively for patients who have irritable bowel syndrome. And through process of elimination, we identify which foods are bothering patients. So, yeah, I mean, it could make things worse for some patients if you, you know, hard to know if it's caused by candida overgrowth necessarily.
Yeah.
But a patient may feel as if they have candida overgrowth with bloating and gassiness
mm-hmm.
and gastrointestinal distension.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting question.
All right, Lorraine.
All right, very thoughtful. All right, this is a good inflection point at which to a break because we split this podcast, as we do all our podcasts, into two parts. So let's mm-hmm. stipulate this is part one, and when we return, give us a tease. What's coming up in part two?
Dr. Hoffman, how do we prevent a future hernia?
A future hernia?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna think long and hard. I'm going to do some mental heavy lifting in order to get ready for that question. All right. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, and we'll be right back with part two of this week's Q&A with Layla. Thanks for joining us.